Howdy and welcome back. No, hold on. Howdy and welcome to the BP Movie Journal, the show we do where we talk about the stuff we've seen since the last time we did one of these. I'm David.
I'm Tyler.
See, I've done your... See, you introduce regular episodes and the Patreon, you get them mixed up. Now, I have a thing where I introduce the Movie Journal and the one where I met your mother.
Oh.
So I always say, welcome back to the one where I met your mother.
Got it. Yes.
That's how I start. So I almost, that's why I combined the two. I said, howdy and welcome back. Can't do that. Got to keep them straight. Got to be profesh. Keep it profesh. So we got a bunch of movies to talk about. We can't do too much fucking around here.
Well, okay. Let's do a little bit of fucking around.
A little bit of fucking around. I'm ready.
Because here's the thing. So I'm sick right now, which means my mind tends to go to dark places. Not overly dark places.
Okay.
But we should specify you have a bunch of movies to talk about. I have a few movies to talk about. And it's just, man, it's just getting to me. Like, it's really like, I know, like, I'm a dad, I've got a couple jobs and I'm sick. I get it. But like, it's really, I don't know. I just felt like letting everyone know where I am. Like, I have no idea if the listeners are disappointed.
I don't think
that I'm not seeing as many movies. I like it's an aspect to parenthood that is probably completely internal, pardon me. I just feel like other people are like, well, I didn't have these kids, but I'm paying the price because I'm not hearing Tyler talk about my favorite movie of the year or whatever. And it's just really, it's really getting to me. So like, I promise everyone, like, I'm really going to try and see more. I have some today, but I promise I'll see more. Like, I'm ashamed of the number of 2021 movies I've seen. And granted, I'm going to see more as we move on, but like, it really bums me out.
Well, I mean, you've got plenty of good reasons. I think you need to like, yes, do what you can to see as many as you are able, but also let yourself off the hook if you're not able to. You have,
I know,
plenty, it's a crazy time in the world, and it's a busy time in your life. And at some point, those kids will, you know, abandon you, leave you all alone. So you should enjoy them while you can.
Right. Oh, they called me just the other day. And oh no, they were just like me, prioritizing family over their work. Wait, what? Okay. Right. Anyway, it was on my mind, and I feel like I owe the world an apology. I know I probably don't, but I know that the show is different than it used to be, and because of this big life change, and you know, and I feel kind of bad about it.
Well, that's all right. I don't think you should, but I also validate your feeling.
Oh, thank you.
All right. So, I don't have much to say about this first film. I, had been meaning to watch it for, a long time because I'm just interested in the subject matter, but I kind of knew, because I don't tend to like biopics, especially musician biopics. I knew I wasn't going to like it, but I still wanted to see how they did it. I watched Liesl Tommy's Respect.
Oh, okay.
Aretha Franklin, biopic. And it's exactly it hits all the biopic notes.
Yeah.
You would expect it to. It's not like it's never like aggressively bad. It's just very much expected. And also it feels like I often point out like run times. But when I tell you this movie is 2 hours and 25 minutes, I want to tell you that you feel that 2 hours and 25 minutes. It is a long movie for something that's like never really unexpected.
That's a long time for formula. I'll say that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you've got a good Jennifer Hudson plays Aretha Franklin. Forest Whitaker plays her father. Marlon Wayans plays her first husband. who else is in there? Mary J. Blige plays Dinah Washington. She actually might be the best part of the movie. She's only in a couple scenes. Mark Maron plays Jerry Wexler, which is fun. So you've got like that, that kind of helps a little bit, just seeing like the, like, oh, and this person and this person and this person. It helps a little bit, but really it's just, I mean, I feel like I'm the millionth person to say this about a biopic, but you could just read the Wikipedia entry, you know, you'll get the, you get the story. And also like, it's weird to like, I feel like a movie, the movie is so long and then it ends in 1972. And it's like, I guess they just felt like we've been going on too long. Like we'll cover the rest of her life. You know, like if you're going to, cause it starts when she's a child. It's, this isn't one of those like biopics that tries to focus in on a certain period of time.
Right.
It's, this is the, like from childhood to like, you know, rising stardom, early, you know, frustrations and struggles and stuff. And then like, we get to the recording of Amazing Grace, the 1972, gospel album that you recorded, and then the rest, everything else is just like either text on screen or what has become my my worst
real footage over the credits.
Yes,
or next to the credits often.
Yes, it is. What's the one I'm looking for? My bete noire, is that what I'm looking for? It's become it's a burr in my saddle. Every movie that is a biopic or is based on real events ends with real footage. And it just, it seems like, what are you trying to, you're trying to like show off how close, cause that's what Eyes of Tammy Faye does, that where it literally like shows an interview with the real Tammy Faye next to the footage we already saw of Jessica Chastain doing that, just as a way of saying like, see how accurate we were.
Yeah. I hated that about The Disaster Artist as well.
Yeah.
Where it's like, hey, look how we recreated this. Yeah. It's one of those things. It really bothers me when I see it as well. And it's happening. I feel like it's happening more and it feels self-congratulatory.
Yes. The first one I really noticed, and this is a movie that is, it's 2022. So this movie that is 10 years old now, Argo.
Sure.
Has like, look how these shots that are, look like, it's like, they're saying, look how well we restaged the like storming of the embassy, or like we rebuilt, the production designers rebuilt this house to the exact like specifications. Like who cares? Like, and that's a movie that I liked for the most part. But it's gone on too long. I feel like there was something else I was going to say about respect, but we can move on to Leos Carax's Annette. We talked about Annette last week, my personal hangups. So I don't want to give the impression that I think this is a bad movie. I think it's a very good movie, actually. In some ways I can see you, I'm sure you do this. Sometimes you watch a movie and you like start hearing why other people might complain about this movie.
Yes.
And then you're like defending the movie against the complaint you haven't actually heard.
Pissed at these people that may or may not exist.
But I could see the complaints about it being a movie that is mostly about a bad man. You know, I can see the people saying like, haven't we had enough of like focusing on bad male behavior or whatever. And I get that. And there are actually times in the movie when the way in which Adam Driver's character is a bad man is kind of expected and wrote that I was like, okay, I get why someone might be tired of this, but what is not wrote or expected about Annette is that it's a musical written by the Sparks Brothers. It has fantastic, weird songs, often like if you saw the Sparks Brothers documentary, you know their music, you know they often have this thing of being like so specific and so straightforward in like their lyrics that it like ends up turning around and becoming avant-garde again. Like it becomes weird that someone's being like so straightforward. And there's a lot of that in the Annette songs. There is also, the thing you want with musicals, which is big, grand emotion. And for all of my complaints about the things that happen in like the first half or half plus of the movie, like seeing him like, oh, because both he and Marion Cotillard are performers. He's a stand up and she's a opera singer. And so you get the thing of like, oh, her career is taking off and his is faltering and he's drinking more because of that. And like, maybe he's a threat to their baby. And that, like, it seems like I've seen this kind of story before.
Yeah.
But grain of salt, but the movie is again, still a musical by the Sparks Brothers and gets to places in its second half with, just huge emotions, just that musical thing of being so big, but in a way that it's not a happy movie. I don't want to spoil what happens in the movie. It's not a happy movie. So that big emotion is regret, or that pain of realizing that you've fucked something up in a way that you can never undo. That stuff is very big. And by the end of an edit, it definitely had me. But so I like Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard, and then Simon Helberg.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Who I guess he's probably best known for The Big Bang Theory. I haven't seen that much Big Bang Theory, but back pre Big Bang Theory, pre Drunk History, there was a web series called Derek and Simon that was Derek Waters and Simon Helberg, that was very funny and that I will always associate him with. So it's weird to see him playing a dramatic musical role when I think of him as like this guy from like, you know, mid 2000s internet alt comedy. But he's good too. All right. And then the Sparks Brothers actually do show up at the beginning as essentially themselves. And then later they have another cameo, which is fun. And then moving on to Adam McKay's Don't Look Up.
Now, all right.
I'm sure what you are expecting is for me to lambast the film. Everyone's done that already.
Sure.
Yes, it's not good. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say here's the reasons Don't Look Up is better than Vice.
Okay.
Or at least not as bad as they're saying. It has some of that Vice stuff. Like most of the, when the comedy in the movie is quote unquote satire, like meaning just thumpingly obvious and eye rolling, it's not funny. It feels like Vice. It feels smug, you know. Michael Chiklis's character is a very minor character in the movie, but he's like essentially a Fox News opinion show talking head type. It's not called Fox News. It's called like Patriot News or something, but he's like, I like Michael Chiklis, but this is,
it's a shame. If it, in other hands, that would be such great casting. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So yeah, that stuff gets old, but what Don't Look Up has that I think Vice was missing is Adam McKay is still a funny guy who made funny movies. And so there is stuff in this movie that is funny that when it doesn't have anything to do with it. A lot of it comes from Leonardo DiCaprio's performance. And the way, here's where I'll praise Adam McKay as a filmmaker. One thing I think he's very good at is giving a sense of ordinariness, even when we're dealing with like major movie stars in or like even outlandish comedic personas like Step Brothers or whatever, they're still like, you still believe that like Richard Jenkins is an ordinary guy in Step Brothers. And so turning Leonardo DiCaprio, one of the, you know, biggest movie stars, and you know, I guess at this point, aging sex symbols in the world, into kind of like a milquetoast, awkward guy without making it seem like he's overreaching.
Right, right.
To making it seem natural. He does a good job of that. And a lot of it is in Leonardo DiCaprio's performance, but a lot of it is just in Adam McKay's kind of, in his better films. Vice, I don't think, did this as well, but his like kind of egalitarian way of shooting. He shoots everybody exactly the same, which I guess could be seen as he only has one mode, but it does tend to make outlandish people seem just as ordinary as everyone yeah. else, which I think in some ways can help at least what he's going for with a movie like Don't Look Up, where he's trying to say, yes, what we're seeing in this movie is outlandish, but it's also not that far from reality. At least that's right. That's what he's trying to say. And I think it works a little bit for that, but it mostly works just for comedy. The maybe it's so like minor, but one of the biggest laughs I had in the movie. So, you know, the premise of the movie, right? I think yeah. everyone knows. Okay. Yeah. So Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence have like gone on TV to try and like get people's attention to like say, this comet's coming, it's going to end life on Earth in just over 6 months or whatever. And like, no one seems to care. Plus they're being like, persecuted by the White House and followed around by the FBI or like kidnapped by the other. Like everything has gone wrong no matter what. And then Jennifer Lawrence, insult injury. She's like, well, I guess on top of everything, apparently my boyfriend just broke up with me, because her boyfriend is a journalist who like wrote like a scathing hit piece on her. And so after all of that, the world is ending, all of that. And she goes, I guess my boyfriend broke up with me. And Leonardo DiCaprio goes, oh, what a day. It's maybe the hardest I laughed in the entire movie.
But you know what? That's a very, when Adam McKay is funny, one of the things that I really like that he is able to do is have characters able to very briefly focus on something that is less important, but it's very important to them in the moment. Like when characters, whether it be in like Talladega Nights or Anchorman, like they'll be arguing or something, and then a slight thing is brought up over here and they address it not too long. Sometimes it is comically long, but they do address it. They take it just as seriously in that moment as anything else, and then it's back to this. So that yeah. like, oh, what a day. That's great. And that that feels very like the kind of Adam McKay I like.
There's another thing that I won't say what the joke is, but there is a running thing where Jennifer Lawrence, a character played by Paul Guilfoyle, if you know that,
I love him. I feel like he's unsung.
Me too. So a character, he does something early in the movie that Jennifer Lawrence like can't let go of. So even as the world like is getting closer and closer to ending, everyone she's bringing up like, what was he? What did he mean when he like it? I won't say what it is, but it's funny. But it also speaks to that thing I was talking about the ordinariness that like Adam McKay doesn't present Paul Guilfoyle's character as a supporting character in the Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence movie. When he's on screen, he's just as much of a character in the movie as everyone else. And I like that. So there you go. I've said some positive things about Don't Look Up, a movie that is ultimately quite bad.
Okay. Okay. So I'm going to take a bunch of things and combine them. So, you know, it speaks to, I feel like it's been 3 weeks since we've done one of these?
Two weeks.
Okay. So, you know, back when Christmas was still going on, when it was a thing, right? Right.
Yeah. When Christmas is a thing, that's
something that's that people are going to, I'm a big fan of A Christmas Carol, as I like the book. And then I like various adaptations of it. And so I watched various adaptations, but I'd seen them before, obviously Muppet Christmas Carol. I'm a big fan of the one with George C. Scott from 1984, I want to say.
Okay.
But oddly enough, the one that up until probably the Muppets was the best known one was from 1951, starring Alistair Sim. I had not seen that one until now. And I've seen many, many versions of this. And so I thought like, oh, you know what? I've never seen this one. Let's give it a watch. And I liked it. I thought it was very good. With a couple of exceptions, most of these adaptations really stay within very specific confines. And this one, definitely, I understand why it has stood the test of time. And I understand why it is often mentioned in the same space as like Muppet Christmas Carol. And I think it's because people like their Scrooge to only be so malevolent, almost comically so. The kind where it's like Mr. Burns, you know, where they're just like, yeah, like, ah, that guy, he's cold and he's ruthless, but he's kind of a rascal, you know, that sort of thing. And as opposed to something like the, in my opinion, you know, ill-conceived Guy Pearce film, which he is great in, by the way, but that is so dark and so like modern world conscious. And then even as much as I love the George C. Scott version, that one has more of an eye towards horror, and his Scrooge has a real edge to him, as opposed to this one where the film in general, everything is heightened to such an extent. And Alistair Sim's Scrooge, both when he is like bad and when he becomes good, like is just so excitable and so big and almost cartoonish. And I don't say that in a negative way, but I can definitely see why this one really stood the test of time. And I think it's because it's something you could watch with your kids, and your kids would get the very basics of the story and the very basics of Scrooge. And so it's a fun performance. And in that way, because in the last few years, there have been a number of articles saying like, oh, Muppet Christmas Carol is the definitive Christmas Carol. It's like, well, it also has the fucking Muppets in it. Like, I mean, I adore it. I think I love the songs. I love the art direction. I think it's a very, very good version, but it is also, there's Miss Piggy. You know what I mean? Like it feels a little wrong to say that's the definitive anything, but I can see why this one for so many decades was considered the definitive one, because it has that tone of approachability and accessibility and that sort of thing. So I'm glad I watched it.
Have you seen Scrooge, the musical where Albert Finney plays?
I have not. That's also a big one that people really like, and they like his performance. But
yeah, I saw that one as a kid. I remember liking it. Yeah. Oh, it's my turn again already.
Yes.
I didn't take enough of a break. Sorry about all right. That. next up, this is going to be like, it's going to be all 2021 movies. This is what I'm doing. Sure. Here, okay. Paul Verhoeven's Benedetta, which I was really looking forward to, and I quite liked it, but it also, I think it delivered on some of the things I was looking for. I wanted it to be like, risque and provocative, and it was that, but I also think I wanted, or I was a bit let down by, it's based on a reportedly true story of a nun in the 1600s during the Black Plague, who may or may not have had like stigmata, and may not have had like Jesus Christ speaking through her or whatever, and there was some disagreement as to whether or not it was a actual miracle, or whether she was perhaps unwell, or maybe, as the movie suggests, might be the case, she's just playing everybody. But she's also carrying on an ongoing lesbian affair with a young, I guess the term would be novitiate. Someone who's like, a woman who's not yet a nun, is like a nun in training. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so this nun is having an affair with this other nun or novitiate. So yeah, it's obviously very provocative. I think I was a bit let down. I don't know why. I shouldn't have been. Paul Verhoeven's never been like a super mystical or spiritual type director, but I felt like I'm bringing my own Catholicism, my Catholic upbringing to it. I felt like the movie did not take Catholicism seriously. Mm-hmm. Like the characters are afraid of the threat of hell.
Right.
I don't think the movie legitimizes that fear.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? Which I think,
do you feel like it's judging them or looking down on them for a fear of hell?
Maybe not quite that, but it does add, and this isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it adds to the feeling of this being an exploitation type of movie. And that's in keeping with Paul Verhoeven's, whole career, that like he makes very artfully made and cinematically adventurous schlock movies, you know, that are also are very smart. I don't want to sound like they're not, but I love Paul Verhoeven movies, but this didn't, I think this didn't, come anywhere near, I guess L would have been his last film, right?
I think so.
And I absolutely loved L. That, it doesn't come anywhere near that in terms of, really feeling like it's going to upset people, which is maybe what I wanted a little bit. I wanted that. I wanted that, that level of Paul Verhoeven provocateur. And I got more of the, here's a bunch of like Catholic iconography and a bunch of, you know, tits and stuff like that. And blood, of course, don't worry. And so I don't know, I feel like I'm doing the opposite of what I did with Don't Look Up. Don't Look Up, I said nice things about a film I didn't like. Here, I'm talking about my criticisms of a film that I actually really did like. I guess I'm doing the thing of responding to the discourse about the movie, maybe more than the movie. And maybe I went in with expectations that weren't fair. But I will say, you know, performances are great in the movie. I also specifically want to shout out Lambert Wilson, who shows up as the, I can't remember if he's a cardinal or a bishop or whatever, but he's the one who's like coming to this small town to like find out if this nun is for real or whatever. But big year for Lambert Wilson, because he, I guess minor spoiler for people who haven't seen Matrix Resurrections yet, but he returns as the Merovingian. I said, when I talked about Matrix Resurrections right after it came out, I was like, you'll be surprised. Like some big names return. And then it's like some weird people, like, I guess they thought that person needed to come back. Sure. But, the Merovingian is back in Matrix Resurrections, and we're all the better for it. He's fantastic. Okay. Sticking with, man, what are you, there've been so many musicals this year.
Yeah.
So West Side Story, I haven't seen In the Heights. You saw In the Heights.
I did.
Annette, Cyrano, and this one, Tick, Tick, Boom.
Right.
And I don't know if maybe I'm telling on myself here by saying that this movie benefited from lowered expectations for me, but I really liked this movie. I also knew nothing about it. I knew it was about Jonathan Larson, who wrote Rent. But I didn't realize Tick, Tick, Boom was a sort of like, I guess in the movie he describes it as a rock monologue, but like a memoirist musical that he had written. I didn't know that. I thought this was like, oh, it's a musical about the guy who made Rent. That's right. I didn't realize it was songs that this guy had written about his life, and that Rent is not a part of the story, because it all, Tick, Tick, Boom was written before he wrote, Rent. This is about his like, I would say early days, but part of the point is that he's been plugging away at trying to have a career in musical theater for a long time. And this is about the sort of crisis of like, do I give up? Do I like try to find a, you know, a job, or do I just be a waiter forever? Or like, is this actually going to happen? I really thought that Lin-Manuel Miranda, who directed it, I don't know if you can blame me for having lowered expectations, like, because it felt like that thing of that Mitch Hedberg thing, like, oh, you can cook really well. Can you farm?
Yes.
It kind of felt like, oh, Lin-Manuel Miranda is really good at these things. Why doesn't he try this other thing that isn't those things? So I had lowered expectations for him as a director, but I have to eat my words there, because I think the movie's sense of reality and theatricality blend surprisingly well. Like the movie actually really does look like, not that I was ever in New York in the 1980s. I was barely ever outside of Missouri in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And I was very young, but it has the look and feel of that its milieu is honest and authentic. And yet it also has the abandon with which to have a musical number break out in the middle of that, not do the thing of like, And now we're into the musical number. Like, right. Things just happen. And some of these, look, I've never seen Rent in any form. I don't really know those songs outside of 5,000, 2,500, 600 minutes. Sure. Cause I feel like that song's kind of inescapable. So I didn't really know much about Jonathan Larson. The songs are good. Now there's a couple of moments that I think show Lin-Manuel Miranda's like neophyte standing, some places that feel a little bit like he's pushing things a little too bit. There's a part, you know, Andrew Garfield as Jonathan Larson, he's got to come up with just this one more song before his musical workshop or whatever. And he goes for a swim at the YMCA and the song comes to him while he's swimming. And then like the camera is above the pool and you see like the lines on the bottom of the pool become like musical, like the notes start filling in as if it's like lines on a chart. And it's like, it seems a little bit too self-conscious. There's also a moment that is supposed to be a huge emotional moment, but it felt so dramatized of that thing. Like a character reveals that he's HIV positive, but it happens in like, you've seen this scene type of scene a million times where like two characters are arguing about something else and the argument like comes to a head and the person is like, I'm HIV positive. And they're like, suddenly everyone's like quiet. Right. Like it sucks. Cause it's like, not only is it a big moment, it is from real life. Like Jonathan Larson's friend actually like, was HIV positive. So it sucks to like roll your eyes when that happens, but there are a couple moments like that keep it from being a full on triumph. But I would say as a first movie, it's better than most.
You definitely, you spoke to my own feelings. I haven't seen the film, but I had the same thoughts. Like I was interested. I was very interested in it. And then when I found out Lin-Manuel Miranda was directing, I was like, oh, okay. Even though, I mean, obviously, you know, like Julie Taymor turned out to be a fascinating film director. Yeah, like it is absolutely possible, even with your first film, to do something really amazing. But I did definitely, my expectations, maybe they didn't drop, but they shifted. And the film just somehow wasn't as big a priority as it was before that.
It wasn't for me, but you know what happened?
What's that?
Netflix sent me a really comfy sweatshirt and I was like, it worked. I got to watch this movie now. This sweatshirt is just silky smooth. it was cold a lot during the Christmas break because it was like raining out. And as we've talked about, was that on air or off air? We talked about with Mariah, how apartments in Los Angeles often aren't insulated, as well as, so like kind of cold in Los Angeles feels way cold.
Sure.
Because when you're inside, because your place is insulated. So I actually did spend a lot of the Christmas break wearing my Tick Tick Boom sweatshirt that Netflix sent me. So maybe subconsciously I actually did watch it for that reason, but
no, and underneath your swimming pool person. T-shirt.
Yeah. That's another call ahead. you keep forgetting, or I don't know if you have forgotten or if you're doing that on purpose.
I'm doing it on purpose. Okay. I'm going to do everything I can to just completely cut take the knees out from the upcoming episode.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm glad you're doing it the way you are referencing the upcoming episode. Cause I don't want to I don't want to talk about movies and say, oh, you'll hear me talk about this on an upcoming episode, because the upcoming episode is Scott's top 10 and we want some surprise. So, as long as it's jokes about references to my swimming pool t-shirt,
That's all it's going to be from.
Yeah. Okay. next up, I watched, Ryosuke Hamaguchi's other 2021 film, Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy. He's Drive My Car is picking up most of the attention, but Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy is also great. I think I actually liked it better. To be honest, it's a anthology. It's a triptych. It's three short films, three short stories in one film. But they do have. They're clearly riffs on similar themes. They're all three of the short stories. One is about two women who are friends who one of them is like talking about her new boyfriend, this new guy she's seeing, and the other one realizes that she's talking about her ex-boyfriend, but doesn't say anything at first. The second one is about a former student or student, former student who goes to see her former teacher on with ulterior motives. And the third one is about two classmates who haven't seen each other in 20 years or so, running into one another again by chance in public. And so they're all three of them are very talky. They're these are all the whole thing. This is a movie in which people talk to one another for pretty much the entire movie. But now, obviously, you and I know that's how drama works. That can be dramatic, but it's especially dramatic because a thing that happens in each one of these is the dynamic keeps changing. Someone goes into a situation thinking it's one thing. Like I mentioned,
sure.
A person is talking about this new guy she's dating. The other woman is listening. And then only afterwards she goes to see her ex-boyfriend to say, like, you're dating my friend. And we're like, oh shit. Like this just recontextualized everything I just saw. And that happens again and again in this movie of people talking naturally, but things coming out that change the dynamic, sometimes for the characters, sometimes for the audience, sometimes often both. And that the skill with which Hamaguchi executes these things that, and I felt this way about Drive My Car as well, that both movies are often about huge universal, just human realities and ideas, but everything often feels kind of like underplayed and effortless at the same time, very smooth. You know, that's how I talked about Drive My Car, especially like how it has a character has a monologue about his driver being such a good driver that he forgets he's in a car while he's driving. And I feel like I haven't seen Hamaguchi's earlier work that was very well received. I need to, because that seems to be a shorthand for kind of his movies, that they feel so smooth and even and so easily watchable, and that you almost don't realize you've stumbled into something, a ginormous moment for two characters, until it's already happening. Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic movie. I loved it. All right. You're up.
Okay, so this is a 2021 movie. I saw Joel Coen's The Tragedy of Macbeth, which I have so much to say about it. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but it's just such a fascinating film because every once in a while, especially like if it's a remake or if it's an adaptation of something that people are very familiar with, there's the question of like, okay, how are you justifying this? Like what compelled you to go and do this? So the idea, first off, just the fact that Joel Coen was doing it by himself already gets one's attention. And is it because Ethan Coen is like, I don't like Shakespeare? That seems unlikely, but it's just fascinating. It's like, because the film does to me feel like somebody who is approaching material that he's very familiar with and like trying to like sort of get a hold of it in his own way. And I don't just mean Shakespeare, because there's a lot of Wells in here, and I think there's some Bergman in here as well. Certainly, if nothing else, there are some like visual references, like the first appearance of the witch, not the first appearance, but like when she first appears to Macbeth, it's like, that's Death on the Beach right there. But also just his own approach to adapting something that's theatrical, because it's undeniably theatrical. It's undeniably, interior. And what's more is it's so sparse. It's almost as though it's like Macbeth by way of our town, you know, because we spend so much time in this, in, you know, these castles that are gorgeous. And yet, like, did they just move in, or have they, like, has their furniture not come yet? Outside of the throne and a few tables for like the banquet scene, it's just so, it's all so empty. And so it's, it definitely is. I feel like so often, especially in the last, I'd say 20 years or so, there's this tendency. It's like, how can we make Shakespeare relevant? How can we modernize it? And this, not only does it not modernize it, it doesn't even really, it removes it from the realm of reality. It exists in this other place of the intersection of theater and film. And that's just from the visual standpoint and the choice to shoot it black and white, the choice to shoot in the aspect ratio that it's in. And then from an art direction standpoint, all of this just conveys a real desolation, a real emptiness, to the material. And that's to say nothing of the acting. And everyone does a really wonderful job. I will, you know, it feels, it's like, I'm going to single out the lead actor. That's a dumb thing to say. I think I forget how well Denzel Washington can lose his mind, like genuinely lose his mind. When we think of Denzel Washington, there's such a strength there, and that's how the character starts. But slowly but surely, like, that's why this is not simply called Macbeth. It's called The Tragedy of Macbeth, because it really, really, we need to see the Denzel we know, the one that is stoic and trustworthy. And slowly but surely, he starts having to just like, oh, I got to take care of that loose end. I got to take care of that loose end. And before you know it, he has the throne, which he seems to take no joy in at all, except so he's essentially defending just like, well, I put the time and effort into it. And so by the end, I mean, he is so sometimes hilariously, sometimes terrifyingly, but in general, just he's so tragically insane by the end. And Denzel Washington's ability to convey that arc, even in maybe especially in the midst of fully grasping the language, it is a marvelous performance. I forget how when I think of stuff like The Manchurian Candidate, or like the end of Training Day, or Flight, or something like that. It's like, yeah, there's this side of him that he's perfectly fine to go into, but we don't see very often. And I think he really does something with the character. I've long thought that like the most dynamic character of Macbeth is Lady Macbeth. It's like, no, she's the most active character. She's not necessarily the most dynamic. And in this, especially, this understands like, no, we are watching a tragedy. We are watching a good man brought down by his own ambition. And boy, it's such a, even I love the moment of his death. The moment where it's like, it's this really great sword fight and his crown falls off, and just, it's the way that he focuses on picking up his crown. They're like, he's disregarding the person that he's fighting because he's focused on this. And that's ultimately his downfall, is that he's focused on the crown, quite literally. I did not expect to love the movie this much, but I do, because I just feel Joel Coen so engaged with the material and trying to like figure it out. And again, I don't just mean Shakespeare. I mean film history and the way film and theater interact with each other. It really was invigorating.
That's exciting. Yeah, you made me excited to rewatch it. I think. All right, so moving on to Rebecca Hall's passing. The title is not a mistake. This is this is a movie that is, it has a story to tell about characters, and it's set in a time and place. But this is a parable about being black and negotiating your way through a white world. You and I sometimes have been hard on movies that are overtly like unpacking ideas that are, I used the word parable in very specifically because it feels like Rebecca Hall is trying to tap into something classical. She's, mm-hmm. And also, it's not a movie that pretends, unlike certain movies, I don't know, that may have like tried to make a point and are just feel like they're lecturing at you, like Vice or, mm-hmm. or like Promising Young Woman or whatever. They feel like they've got it figured out and they're going to tell you how it is.
Yeah.
This is a movie that doesn't know. So it's more of like a dialectic almost, but I mean, that there's more than two viewpoints. The movie, Tessa Thompson plays she's a light skinned black woman, but she's married to a black man. She lives in a black community. She reconnects with a childhood friend played by Ruth Negga, and who is also obviously a light skinned black woman. Mm-hmm. And then realizes that, oh, she's living as a white woman. She's married to, Alexander, Skarsgård, and, he doesn't know that she's black. And then, but Ruth Negga, when she runs back into Tessa Thompson, starts like realizing she's missed something of like the culture she grew up in, and starts like hanging out with Tessa Thompson and her husband, who's played by Andre Holland, who's also fantastic in the movie, more and more. And, I mean, sign of a good movie, Bill Camp is in it. Bill Camp plays, for the time, what would have been considered a very like progressive, white, like, media figure who also hangs out with, the black characters a lot of the time. The movie's in like 1:3:3 aspect ratio. It's black and white. It feels like it's trying to like tap into the history of not only of the actual history that it's exploring of different methods of just survival for black people in white culture, but also the history of film and storytelling and art as a way of unpacking these ideas. I really liked the movie more than I thought I would, which seems to be a thing. Like, okay, maybe you and I need to just cast aside our thing of like actors turn directors, because they keep making good movies lately.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm just wrong. Cause yeah, I didn't expect this to be this good. But a lot of it is down to the performances are fantastic. Everyone I mentioned, maybe especially Andre Holland, is really compelling in the movie. But really surprised me. And Netflix didn't even have to send me a sweatshirt.
Oh man,
they sent me a book. But
oh, okay,
they send books for all their movies. I have so many books, like big coffee table books for different movies, that right now I actually, you know, my Hand of God book and my Passing book are on either side of the TV stand behind it, because my cat kept going behind the TV and accidentally unplugging the modem and we'd lose internet. So now I have used Hand of God and Passing coffee table books to keep the cat from getting to where the modem is. That's what I'm using them for.
Wow. Right. I think maybe that's one small step up from you're using them to like keep your table level or something like that.
But I mean, you could also make the argument that like I'm able to watch Netflix when my modem is connected.
There you go.
Right. So
there you go.
Yeah, they're standing sentry. All right. And then next up, I watch. Speaking of like, maybe I need to let go of hangups that I have. Okay. A couple of years back, Jim Jarmusch makes a documentary about the Stooges.
Right.
And I was like, oh, this would be so cool. I tend to be bored by musical like bio docs or whatever, but this is Jim Jarmusch. He's going to bring something to it. Right.
Yeah.
Not really. The Stooges movie is not that great. And then earlier this year, Edgar Wright makes me about the Sparks Brothers. So I was like, oh, yeah. Edgar Wright, he's going to bring something fun to it. No, not really. It's just a pretty traditional. So then when it came out, like Todd Haynes is making a Velvet Underground movie, I was like, I will not be burned a third time.
Yeah.
Well, I'm an idiot because it turns out it's great. It's the best, absolute best version of these. It's maybe not as, I mean, and Todd Haynes is one of those directors, kind of like a Gus Van Sant, that is always like nearly like riding the edge of avant-garde. Oh, Gus Van Sant has made some like more overtly avant-garde films, but mm-hmm. Todd Haynes tends to make like movies that you could watch with like a non-cinephile and they would get something out of it. But also cinephiles realize that he's working at maybe a higher level. And so the Velvet Underground doc, it's not what I kind of went in, like reading reviews and people saying good things, but I was like, oh, is this going to be like an almost experimental documentary about the Velvet Underground? Is it going to be like, do you remember that Marlon Brando documentary, Listen to Me, Marlon?
Yes.
Which was like an experimental documentary about Marlon Brando, which I love. I was like, is it going to be that? It's not quite that. It is still like, it tells the story of the Velvet Underground. But it also, my test of these movies often is like, is this documentary about this band or this musician more enriching than just listening to their music for an amount of time? I don't know if it necessarily is, but he's made a movie that kind of feels like a Velvet Underground record.
Mm.
The way he uses like collage and then uses the very Warholian, because they come from the Warhol world, mm-hmm. the Warholian thing of like just the opposite of montage or collage, just like leaving the camera on a person for a very long time, you know. And it feels like it's a movie, it is a film born from the same impulses and the same heady cultural mixture that gave birth to the Velvet Underground. It's really a really great watch. It's also crazy to think that this movie covers roughly the same amount of the same time period as Respect, but feel like they take place in completely different Americas. And that's sure. not a criticism of either film. Like that is just an acknowledgement about American culture, that it is multiple things at the same time, and sometimes those things are happening in just completely different tracks and they don't overlap. So the idea that I watched two movies about American music that took place over the same period of time that feel like they're on from different planets. And then I also want to point out drummer Maureen Moe Tucker of the Velvet Underground. Okay, people who follow the Velvet Underground know that she has veered hard right in her politics in many ways. She's a Tea Partier. There's a famous interview where she said she's become convinced that Barack Obama is trying to destroy America from within. Like, so all that said, obviously I don't agree with her. As an interviewee about the Velvet Underground, she is often the most entertaining part of the movie. Because one of the like weirdest parts of the movie is the Velvet Underground being very 60s New York, go to play like some shows in California and San Francisco, or in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and like that fish out of water feeling of like the black clad, pale skinned, heroin shooting band like trying to hang out around the pool, you know, is hilarious. But it leads Mo Tucker to go off on a rant about the uselessness of hippies that is the funniest part of the movie. With that said, we will be right back.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, what's next for you?
Next for me, David, we're watching all kinds of modern black and white movies.
Well, there's a lot of them this year.
I know. It's vaguely off-putting. But yeah, next for me is Mike Mills' Come On, Come On, which you've seen. Yes.
Yes, but we didn't get to talk about it on the Movie Journal because I believe I was still under embargo at the time we recorded. Oh. So I have not. You can read my review at battleshippretention.com, but I've not talked about it on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that. But yes, I suppose listeners could if they wanted to. I really liked it. I might even love it. You know, it's so interesting how much just even in this conversation, but I think as you and I get older and the longer we do this, it's interesting how much the concept of expectation comes into play. And I think it's because we've been doing this long enough or we've seen enough movies that we kind of, you can't help but go in with an expectation, positive or negative, about the quality of a movie, or at least kind of what it's going to be about. I definitely had an expectation of Come On, Come On, just based on what I'd heard about it and just the nature of the story. And the film thankfully was, and I was excited to see it. It felt like, it was like, oh, this is going to be sort of a feel good kind of thing. It's kind of amusing and sort of in some ways, almost a funny Kramer versus Kramer, albeit not with a father, but with an uncle. Certainly not going to be a Manchester by the Sea situation. And it is often funny. It is not necessarily, it's not necessarily like a laugh out loud funny, though it is occasionally that. Nor is it a drama. In fact, it's a film that often feels improvised, and yet movies that are improvised rarely feel quite so ethereal as this one does. It's really an achievement for that the film feels the way it does, that it is a dialogue and character driven film, and yet it felt to me almost not necessarily like a Malick movie or anything like that, but that as the characters are talking, they're being very direct in the stuff that they're saying, and yet seem to be operating what they're saying, at least for us, seems to be operating on a higher level. And I think that's done as far as pacing, as far as the music that's happening over it. The fact that it's shot in black and white, it has a dreamy, again, ethereal quality. And so I was just like, what is this movie about? Like, I know what the story is, but what's it about? And it just seemed to be such a, and Joaquin Phoenix's character, his job, which requires that he like interview kids about the future, about their own thoughts, while also dealing very directly with this kid. And so he sees, the behind the scenes moments with being a kid, and he's reflecting on his own life. And it just seems to be, it's an interesting reflection on getting older and being older, and then trying to, when you're young, trying to figure out what's expected of you. And when you're older, trying to recognize how have I lived up or not lived up to expectations, even if they're my own, and just all the way these things interact. Because I really like that it wasn't a situation where he's like the cool uncle who has things figured out, nor is it a situation where this kid is wise beyond his years and he's teaching something to us, the adults. No, it's a combination of the two. And it really is just people trying to figure things out. And I really loved the tone of the movie. And I do think that Woody Norman as the kid is so organic, so believable, so natural. And I really love because they give him some tough stuff to do. Mm-hmm. And yet stuff that feels 100% organic, that makes sense. This orphan character that he plays, and little touches like that. It's the kind of specificity that you and I often talk about, where it's like, who on earth would ever think of that? It's like a kid would think of that 100%. And I totally buy it. And there are aspects to this story that I feel like I might not have bought if done in a slightly different way. And I haven't spoken about Gabby Hoffman either. I think she's marvelous.
I was going to, if you didn't.
Yeah. I think she does such a great job of, like, and she's got some tough stuff to say as well, because the way she sort of pontificates about parenting, like you run the risk of her almost looking straight at the camera, you know, and saying, ah, here's the thing. It's all fucked up. Like, you know, she's almost, providing some kind of philosophy, and yet she grounds that and makes it seem like a very real line of discussion. And so I really, really responded to it.
I didn't like it as much as you, because I think I was a little bit too turned off by the like cutesiness of the running thing about like what Joaquin Phoenix's job is, you know, and all that, like just coming so close to like kids say the darndest things, but it's more like kids say the most profound things.
Sure.
I didn't like that. I did respond well to what you're talking about, him not being the cool uncle as it figured out, because as a man, I am pushing 40. I will be 40 this year.
Yeah.
And I am childless, and that is by choice. That's what I want. But there's a part in the movie where Joaquin Phoenix is like complaining to Gabby Hoffman, the kid's mom. And he says, I can't really exist because it's been months now, but the line is something like, he's spoiled, or maybe I am. And yeah, like that feeling of, and I'm sure that even people who have children still have that feeling of not fully being an adult, but that feeling of like, am I just, did I ever like, because I don't have kids, did I ever stop being a kid? Am I still a kid in some way? That stuff spoke to me. I was still too turned off by the cutesiness elements of the movie to fully embrace it. But I liked that sympathy for the what the fuck am I doing childless adult.
And I, you know what, I actually really like the choice of what his job is, because he has had the freedom and still has the freedom to engage with these kids basically still on his terms. Like, I've got the mic, I'm the one recording, I'm the one asking questions. You can decide whether you answer or not, but I'm the one in charge. And when the time, and when I'm done with the interview, I'm going to walk away from you, having gotten what I can get out of it. But now he's got, so like he's been able to retain freedom and control in his life in regards to the idea of children. Now here's a situation where, yes, the kid can be philosophical, but he sees all the other stuff as well. The stuff that's not so cute, yeah, or not so profound. And so it's just like, oh boy, yeah, this is a lot harder than you think. Like we certainly, maybe it's admittedly, like I watched the movie at a certain time in my life where I'm a new father and I'm feeling a lot of the same things where it's like, yeah, I was able to like watch my friend's kids and be like, oh my gosh, they're adorable. Well, I'm going home to go and do whatever the fuck I want. Yeah. And now that is not an option. And so I definitely, even though he's essentially a father figure in the film, so I definitely related to him in that way. But I get what you're saying. Yeah.
All right. Next up, Michael Rianda and Jeff Rose, The Mitchells versus the Machines. Color me like confused by what everyone's over the moon about. It's a fun movie. It's cute and sweet by the end. And it has, really eventually when it finally gets going, it has some really fantastic animated action set pieces that reminded me in some ways of Kung Fu Panda, in the way that like they're like super kinetic and choreographed, but also like even though the physics don't make sense in the real world, they make sense within like I buy the physics of how these things are happening in this animated world. So when it's an action movie, it's an animated action movie, it's very good. Mm. The problem is it's nearly an hour of first act before it gets there of lame character and obvious character setup. And then the thing, this is where I feel like I'm going to piss off people who really like the movie. It's not funny.
Mm.
It's produced by Lord and Miller. And so I was hoping for a Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs type of sense of humor. And it feels, the sense of humor feels like a copy of that kind of sense of humor. It's like, you know, kinetic and explosive, and there's freeze frames and text on the screen, and there's like crazy stuff that happens, but it feels like it's trying too hard to be the Lord and Miller type of comedy. Whereas I think, as far as animated comedy action movies go, the Lego Batman movie from 2017 or 2018, whatever that was.
17, I think. Yeah.
That one worked for me. That one I found very funny. And also bought it as a Batman movie, which I didn't expect going in. I thought it was going to be like a parody of Batman movies, but no, it's that the Lego Batman movie is a Batman movie. That's also very silly and funny at the same time.
Yeah.
This one, I just couldn't get all the pieces, together. It also, like I said, it also takes way too long to get going. And I also think it's a very, very, mainstream and institutionalist in its so-called critique of like the effect of, tech, like big, like sure, tech corporations and stuff on our lives. It seems to be like critiquing, how we're under the sway and under the thumb and at the whim of these companies. But then it also has this cop out of like this one bad apple type of cop out that I, one bad apple, get it?
I didn't mean
that. So yeah, can't really recommend The Mitchells versus the Machines. What I can recommend, I don't know why I waited so long to see this movie. I knew I was going to love it. In terms of like lists of, if I were to make a list of movies of 2021 that are the most metal, in different kinds of genres of metal, I would definitely have to put David Lowery's The Green Knight on there as far as in terms of like stoner, like doom metal type of stuff. That's like, obsessed with fantasy and medieval fantasy. I loved The Green Knight so much. You saw it, right?
I did.
Yeah. I really loved, Dev Patel's performance, mm-hmm, as like our hero, but not a hero.
Right.
I also liked David Lowery's willingness to, have the movie change what it was from scene to scene. It kind of feels, episodic, and there are parts that like don't necessarily have any, you know, bearing on the plot as it were, but are just like beautiful and weird and some often very scary. There's a darkness, but also an allure. I've known who Alicia Vikander is since probably A Royal Affair, which is like over 10 years old now. But, in this year, especially with this and Blue Bayou, I've come to realize that she's one of my favorite actresses. And I also, have an enormous crush on her, which I don't think I realized, earlier in her career that I did, but, she's got, I guess she's plays two roles in The Green Knight. And that's when I talk about it being metal and being like psychedelic, like stoner metal, that the allure of things that are also terrifying is something that I found coming up again and again in The Green Knight. It's a beautiful film, but beautiful in a way that is dark and sick and maybe dangerous, but also not something you can't look away from. It's gorgeous. Like the whole, I mean, there's Alicia Vikander has a whole monologue about the color green, that the color green is the color of life, but also the color of rot and gangrene, mm-hmm, and death. And it's also like when you die, you're buried, and then the grass will grow green over you. And so that, that circle of life, beauty and death and scariness and sex and all the stuff, it's such a fantastic, fun mixture to spend over 2 hours in. And also David Lowery, especially in this film in general, but especially in this film, there is, when I talked about, certain scenes not like being plot pertinent, there is not a certain single shot in this movie that is there because it just has to be. He has clearly considered every single shot in the movie for maximum impact in beauty and weirdness and allure and all of this stuff. I mean, there's even there's a close up of semen that is like,
yeah,
but it's a gorgeous shot. It's not like the movie isn't embarrassed. Like maybe Gawain is embarrassed that he just came or whatever, but yeah. Like the movie isn't embarrassed for him. The movie is like, oh, look at this cool, like, liquid like seeping into the cloth. It's a beautiful shot in a movie that is all beautiful shots. I love The Green Knight so much.
Yeah. It's a film that has, I think when I talked about it, on a movie journal, I don't think I was quite as effusive as I would be now if I were to talk about it, because I think I was still like working on it. And I was like, no, I think I just need to embrace it as an experience. And I do think, and I know that like you're a bigger fan of Excalibur than I am, but I do feel like it's nice. It'd be a really nice companion piece to Excalibur. Like if you watch them in the same night, I feel like you get a real strong sense of like what Arthurian myth really was. Like we romanticize it. It's like, yeah, but there's still a lot of ugliness. There's a lot of sensuality. There's a lot of violence. Like all of these things like go together. I wouldn't be surprised if David Lowery was like influenced by Excalibur in making this film.
Well, the movie I thought of while watching this, and this is a minor spoiler if I give away too much, so maybe fast forward if you want to know, but I thought a lot about The Last Temptation of Christ by the end of the movie, but I can't really go too far into that without spoiling things, but that was the movie that I came away thinking. And in fact, since I watched this a little over a week ago, I've been itching to rewatch The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yeah. Oh, there's definitely an influence there. Okay. So next up, this is a film. There's a rewatch, but I hadn't seen the film in, I guess, about 8.5 years since it first came out. Jen was watching it. And so I thought like, oh, okay, I'll give it a shot. And it is Frozen, Disney's Frozen. Because when I first saw it, I was like, I really did not care for it. And neither did Jen. And so she thought she'd give it another shot. And so I watched it with her and, yep, no, I'm right. Still bad.
I like it. I only saw the once, but I like it.
There's a couple of good sequences. The Let It Go sequence is very good. And then I am a sucker for the Olaf snowman character. I think a lot of that is Josh Gad's delivery of things. Okay. And I really like his song, even though it doesn't really, I think one of the things that bothers me is just like the songs, none of them seem to exist. The whole thing just feels like a patchwork to me, which wouldn't necessarily bother me, except that they just seem to clash so much, which for me, and it just invites me to think of sequences that I like and sequences I don't. And in the end, there are more sequences I don't like than ones I do. But I do love Olaf's little song about the summer and wanting to live in the heat. And this time around, I like paid more attention to the lyrics, and like everything is just like tailored around this character just being so unaware of things. Like there's a line where he says, he goes, I'll do whatever frozen things do in summer. And just like, he never references what it could be. And then for some reason, I love, there's a line where he says like the cold and the hot are both so intense, put them together, it just makes sense. And I love that. And I think he sells it. So like, there are things I genuinely love about it. But overall, it was just so, I find it so frustrating, because just when it's starting to get like a rhythm going, like, okay, I'm enjoying this, I like the character dynamic, it'll pivot to this other thing, this other moment. And I'm like, what is this? Why is this here? Like it felt like they had like 5 short films and then just decided to put them all together and like, yeah, no, this will work out fine. And for many people it did, but it still does not for me. Thumbs down on Frozen.
Okay. Maybe Frozen 2 is for you.
Maybe. I haven't seen it.
I almost was like, oh yeah, I never saw the sequel. And then I was like, oh wait, yes, I did. I did see Frozen 2.
That's not a good sign.
Yeah. But I didn't remember it at first. All right. I don't know what else to say. Aaron Sorkin's being the Ricardos. It's everything you think it is going to be. I didn't enjoy it. It's like handsomely made, and it's got, I mean, Aaron Sorkin is still doing Aaron Sorkin, which I used to like, but it's, I guess it's sort of like, I also like going back over 10 years, I used to listen to Adam Carolla's podcast and like the kind of somewhat early days of podcasting. And then after a certain point, I realized like, I think I've like heard everything this guy has to say.
Yeah.
Which I know you and I repeat ourselves often enough, we could be accused of the same, but at least we're talking about new movies, you know, that we haven't talked about before. Hopefully that keeps it somewhat fresh. And I think that's the same thing with Aaron Sorkin. It's like, yeah, there was a time I liked this and I don't hate it now. I don't know if it's gotten worse. I've changed, but also it hasn't changed.
Right.
He's still doing the Aaron Sorkin thing. And like, so there are lines that like, again, like 20 years ago, I would have been like, oh, what if that's a great, sharp little line. You know, there's a part where there's a big scene where Lucy and Desi have to tell the president of CBS or whoever that she's pregnant. Like, you know, they're kind of trying to work it into the show. And it's a big like scandal, whatever. And then like later in the movie, she comes to the president of CBS to like tell him something else. And he says like, oh, I thought you were going to tell me you were pregnant again. And she says, no, I'm still pregnant from before. Which is like, that's an Aaron Sorkin line. I would have liked that, but here I'm just like, I don't hate it, but like, that's what he does. It also has a very ill-advised like framing device where actors, good actors, Linda Lev and Ronnie Cox and Josh Rubenstein, play grown-up versions of, when I have to say them in the order that I said them, Alia Shawkat, Jake Lacy, and Tony Hale, being interviewed about the week of the production of I Love Lucy, in which the movie takes place. It's jarring and so false and fake. It's a terrible idea. Aaron Sorkin should not have done that, especially if it's, you're going to have, I mean, maybe this is me being too much of like a movie buff or whatever, but like, these are supposed to be like real life versions of real people coming on this. And one of them is Ronnie fucking Cox. Like,
yeah,
I know who that is. I know that's not grown up Jake Lacy. That's Ronnie Cox. I saw like him that you in say Deliverance.
Grown up.
Yeah. Jake Lacy's a big like boy.
Yeah, I could see that.
So
Ronnie Cox is he's a recognizable guy. Yeah. It's like, hey, that's a guy from RoboCop.
Yeah. And Josh Rubenstein is maybe not as recognizable as everyone as he is to me, because he was on Angel for a couple seasons. So I think of him as that, but, all right. So from a bad movie to a great movie, Jane Campion's The Power of the Dog, which you saw, right?
I did. Yes. Yeah.
Well, I thought we talked about this.
There's a lot I didn't say because I didn't want to like spoil things, but like, I feel like I just keep thinking about it. My mind keeps returning to it.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's to go back to in a very different way, in a different field, but what I was saying about, the Green Knight, there's not a wasted moment in The Power of the Dog. Even like things, again, to go back to what I was saying about Annette, things that seem like obvious, like we've seen this type of character before, this type of character dynamic before, but everything feels real and honest and, considered and fresh. You've got, it's a very talky movie. But I think the screenplay is one of those that's often the characters talk a lot, but it's often more about what they're not saying.
Yes.
But sometimes what they're not saying is very obvious. Like the, Phil is Benedict Cumberbatch's character, right?
Yes.
And he talks about like this guy whose name is Bronco Henry, who like taught him how to be a ranch hand or whatever. And like, the movie is not really subtle about what's going on there, right. But I think it makes up for that obviousness with, such a, honest emotions in the performances, but also in the way that Jane Campion strings them together, the way that she shoots them, and that she lets certain shots breathe. Yeah. What were you going to say?
Well, and also, like, it's there's a simplicity to the fact of things, but there's a complexity in the way that it has manifested. Benedict Cumberbatch's character, you get him pretty quick, and you kind of and probably about halfway through, it's like, okay, I understand this other element of him, and yet the specifics that they've given to him about like the family he comes from, how his brother turned out,
yeah,
versus how he turned out, and you start to be like, okay, how, like, a lot of these are conscious choices he's made, and then it's like, why did he make those choices? Oh, I guess because of this thing over here, which I'll stay vague about. Like, I guess this thing over here, but what an interesting way to embrace that. And so, and this is something that, you know, as we get down the line, maybe it'll wind up in my top 10, maybe not, I'm not sure. But like, as we get down the line, like maybe in a couple months, we can talk more overtly about the specifics. Cause I've got that character. Yes. We've seen characters like him before, but not him.
And we've seen, or I think, again, not to get into spoilers, we think we've seen characters like Cody Smith McPhee's character before. Yes. But he turns out to be not entirely what we assumed, or what Phil assumed he was at first glance. All right, you're up next.
Okay, next for me is Cary Fukunaga's No Time to Die, the last Daniel Craig Bond movie. I know that sounds crazy because it's this big event, not just in the world of James Bond, but also it was a big movie this year. You know, it was a big theatrical release. And I like a lot of the things in it. I think Daniel Craig is great there. I think there are a couple really, really great action sequences that have a nice virtuosic quality to them. And yet, I watched it like 3 days ago, and I barely remember it. I barely cared about it while I was watching it. I feel like it's a real waste of Rami Malek. His character is just so generic. And I understand, like, you know, there, when people say, oh, a Bond villain, like, well, we all have an idea of what that means. But I do think that for the most part, the Daniel Craig Bond movies have done pretty well at bringing different things to the Bond villain. Certainly not here though. And yeah, I wish I liked it more, but I really don't. Cause I like Cary Fukunaga, and I really expect, I guess I expected more from this. Cause I really think that like Sam Mendes did some good stuff with the series, and I was excited to see what, Fukunaga would do. And it wound up just being, in my view, just a completely run of the mill, occasionally effective, story. And I think Daniel Craig is doing some good stuff, but overall, who cares? I didn't.
All right. Well, moving on to another very metal movie from 2021, but where The Green Knight was like stoner metal, Julie Ducournau's Titan is like grindcore, brutal death metal. Like it is just under 2 hours of incredibly upsetting stuff, but in a way that I loved. I loved Titan so much. I didn't see Raw. It seemed like it was up my alley. Now I feel like I have to see Raw, her previous movie. Because Titan is, it could be correctly described as body horror. And in some ways, in the ways that you think of, it's about a woman who is essentially gets impregnated by a car and has some sort of like, she has a very rapidly proceeding pregnancy, and whatever is in her is leaking motor oil and seems to be made of chrome and light and is very uncomfortable for her.
So, I did not know this was the story.
Oh, okay.
The film has now rocketed to the top of my priorities list.
So it has, so like that sort of like unexplained changes happening to the body. That's a kind of body horror that you're, that, I mean, not that you're used to. I'm not going to say that the movie about a woman getting pregnant by a car is run of the mill, but it, that's like the service level body horror. There's also a lot of the kind of body horror I like, which is about potential body horror. Like sometimes seeing something awful happening to a person's body is not as upsetting as the potential, the sustained potential that something terrible might happen. There's a scene at the very beginning, the actress, the actress's name is Agatha Roussel and her character is Alexia, and she's like a model at car shows. And so we open with her like sort of like dancing on the hood of this, the car that will later impregnate her. And then we get to like the sort of locker room at this convention where all of the models are like showering together, and Alexia like drops something and bends down and her hair gets caught on the nipple ring of the girl next to her. And there's, so there's this very sustained scene of them trying to untangle hair from a nipple ring. And you're like, oh, don't pull too hard. That's going to hurt. So, like, and that, I swear, it's, there's so much of that in the movie. There's 40, 45 minutes in the movie that goes by before you get a relief from that kind of body horror. That's what the, whole, like, first nearly half of the movie is about. And then it, and then I'm not even like, you'd think that I'd given away something by saying this is a movie about a woman impregnated by a car. No, that happens early on. There's actually the actual meat of the movie happens later and is about a story that I haven't even brought up. But still involves the woman who's been impregnated by a car the entire time. So I won't get into that, but this kind of provocation and unsettlement, is so handled so, I don't want to say delicately to sound like it's soft. It's handled, what's what I'm looking like? Precisely is the word I'm looking at. There's a precision to how upsetting this movie is, even as sometimes the camera is, doesn't seem, you know, is just sort of like following someone around or like whipping back and forth or whatever. There's still a precision. Julia Ducournau knows what she's doing to you, the viewer, at all times. And the movie is, very upsetting and very sad, but also completely unlook away from a bull. And also there's a character played by Vincent Lindon, who's an actor I like, but who I most recently saw as Casanova in Casanova Last Love, which listeners and people who read my review will know that I didn't like. So it's good to see Vincent Lindon in a movie that I love again. All right. And now, so the movie about the body horror was easy to talk about. Now, do you ever have a movie you love so much that you dread having to like put it into words?
Yes. Oh yes.
Joachim Trier's The Worst Person in the World is a towering monumental movie. It is stunning and so invigorating in its willingness to dive into its situations and its character's life and see what happens. It never feels like programmatic. It's about a young woman who we find at the beginning, we see her sort of like jumping from major to major in college. And she, it's a Norwegian movie. And she, you know, then is like, oh, I'm going to be a photographer and I'm going to be a writer. And then she has like a jobs out of college as a part-time job at a bookstore while she's trying to write. And then she meets a guy and they have a relationship. And then like her situation just keeps changing, but she's not like a flighty person. This is about a person who she's the same person. She's trying to figure out the world around her, I think is how I feel about the movie. You know, our editor at large, Scott, and I has talked a lot about how many major filmmakers seem to like go out of their way to not make movies about the present.
Yeah.
The Worst Person in the World is a movie that is absolutely about the present. And I think it's about being young today in of we associate the word young. You say young and carefree. That's the thing you say.
Sure.
The world, especially like the Western world as it is today, that like if you're halfway aware of what's going on, it's not so possible to be carefree because you know too much about the rest of the world. You know that your actions have ripple effects, or that the thing you buy might have come from, a thing you buy innocently at a drugstore right. might have had origins in some sort of human rights abuse somewhere. Like the world is not a place to be carefree. And yet there are moments in the movie that are, when the movie gets a little bit, leaves reality a little bit. There are moments that feel like freedom, that have images of freedom running, you know, and things like that. But they're not entirely real. There's something that maybe that the character who's, I just watched this movie the other night, and I'm so bad with character names. Julie or Julia in the Norwegian. She wants to feel things a lot of the time more than she's actually able to. And I think that's what leads to her constantly like changing things, about her life. But I'm not even getting into how beautiful the movie is, in its framing. It made me glad for a movie that's about, you know, just a person going from, you know, job to apartment to party, whatever. It's not like a Western or a sci-fi movie that has vistas, but it made me glad that I have a big TV. I watched it at home. It spends a lot of time taking in the sky above where Julie is, in a way that I feel like is twofold. It's like you can see the sky. The sky's the limit, right? That's a saying that people mm-hmm. have. You can see the sky is representing possibilities and freedom and the future, but you can also see the sky as a great big massive thing on top of you that makes you feel small and diminished and crushed. And it, like for Julie, that's what life is. Both of those things at the same time. And then there's about everything else too. It's when I say it's hard to, when I said before, it's hard to describe, it's because it is about so many things about being a person today that it's hard to pin down. I absolutely just loved The Worst Person in the World.
All right. So my last film, is a rewatch, but it's been well over 20 years since I've seen it. I think maybe I haven't seen it since the theater.
Okay.
So it was probably 25 years. But
hold on, let me go. Can I guess?
Oh boy. Okay.
1996.
Yes. Is it 96?
Well, I guess 97 would be 25
it's,
years.
It's 95.
Oh, 95. And you saw it in the theater and you haven't seen it since. Is it Copycat?
It is not Copycat. No.
Okay.
It is.
I was only giving myself one guess. And I didn't
okay.
Get
all
it.
Right. Oh man.
Copycat did come out in 1995 though. I give myself credit for remembering
that's
that.
That's not bad. Yes. Boy, if we had time, I'd say let's do a fun game and just have you try and guess what it is. But
we don't have time.
We don't have time. Yeah. So yeah, this is another situation where Jen was watching it and I was like, oh, you know what?
Wait, have you said what it is yet?
No, okay. I was about to. It's like, okay, you know what? I haven't seen Jumanji in quite a while. Gosh. So I
also have not seen that since the theater.
And there are a lot of things I do not care for about it. One of them, I hate to say it, is Robin Williams' performance. I just feel like he's, I don't know. It's, I forget, like, obviously, like, because he, you know, passed so young and because he's done so much, you know, he had done so much. I think we kind of idealize him, but there are times when his performance feels a little phoned in or whatever. I mean, when he's engaged, it can be amazing. But in this film, it really didn't feel like that. It felt very standard kind of thing for him. So that's unfortunate. However, David Alan Grier is in it. I forgot completely that he was in it, and he plays the supporting role, and he's quite delightful. My big takeaway, because I had forgotten that Joe Johnston directed it, and my big takeaway was like, it is unfortunate that we only do profiles on these days on people that have passed. Because Joe Johnston's career is fascinating to me. I think of him as such a reliable.
Tyler, the same fate awaits us all.
Someday Joe Johnston will die. No, the bell will soon toll for Joe Johnston. But it's that sort of thing where like, he's a guy who has made a number of movies that I don't necessarily respond that well to. And yet he's made some movies I really love to such an extent that when I hear that, I remember when it was announced that he was going to be directing the first Captain America, I was like, yes, 100%. I remember The Rocketeer. Yes, let's do it. And yet like he's made stuff that is not particularly good. He made Jurassic Park 3 and in watching Jumanji, I was like, oh, I can see why he got that. There is a Spielbergian quality to him. He's not quite as good, but I think he retains the spirit of Spielberg a lot more than, say, a Roland Emmerich. And this does feel like that. There is a sense of fun and harmlessness to it. But like, again, looking at his filmography, he did Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. He did The Rocketeer, which is obviously great. He did the Wolfman, the Benicio del Toro Wolfman, which I really enjoyed. He's just he's a very reliable director. He's this nice, sturdy, two-fisted kind of director. And he's someone that I would, down the line, if we're still doing this, I don't know how old Joe Johnston is. I would love to do a profile of him.
He will be 72 this year.
Okay. But yeah, he's someone that I would like to talk about at some point, because he holds a really interesting little he occupies an interesting little chunk of Hollywood where he's responsible for some really, really great movies. And even when his movies aren't that great, you still feel like you're in good hands.
Yeah. Well, if we do that someday, do that profile, it'll give me an excuse to finally watch The Nutcracker and the Four Realms, which I
saw that in the theater.
Did you? Okay. He only directed the reshoots of. It's a Lasse Hallström film, and then they reshot it. And I guess he reshot enough of it to earn credit. So they're both credited directors on the movie. But that's one of those, because that was like a November release. That was one of those that like felt like it was supposed to be a big thing. And then no one seemed to care about it. I never saw it. You saw it in the theater though.
I did. I think that was back when MoviePass existed. And so I just went and saw a bunch of stuff and I was just like, sure, why not? I'm in the mood for Christmas and good art direction. I seem to recall.